You're listening to STEMcast, brought to you by McGill iGEM.
Hello, everyone. My name is Molly.
And my name is Nick.
And we're joined today by Dr. Peter Guter, who is a professor of the Department of Physics here at McGill University, researching the structure and engineering of materials at the nanometer scale. So thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us, Peter.
Well, happy to do so, Molly and Nick. Looking forward to our discussions.
All right. To start us off, could you please tell us about your personal journey through academia and how you were introduced to the field of nanoscience?
Sure. how far do you want me to go back? So probably reasonable. So I'm originally Swiss. I did my undergrad and graduate studies at the University of Basel in Switzerland. And during my undergrad, I did an exchange with North America. Actually, I was in Ottawa with one of these YASTE summer student internships. And I kind of liked North America, some of the campuses and some of the atmospheres on the way universities are organized here. So when I finished with my diploma, which is roughly a master's, I told my prof back in Switzerland, I'm going to North America because I'd applied to a bunch of grad schools and had been accepted. So he in Switzerland, that at that time at least, was not viewed favorably if you changed institutions for your PhD, essentially. So he kind of suggested strongly to me that I stay and gave me this paper, the original atomic force microscopy paper, which I'll refer to as AFM, atomic force microscopy, and said, hey, don't you want to build one of these things? So this was the first paper by Binnick, Coit, and Gerber that showed this atomic force microscope, which I guess I can tell in a second about how it actually works in that sense. But essentially, you know, and he made a strong case that instead of going to North America, taking a bunch of grad level courses, doing prelim exams, etc., the way he phrased it, you can kind of do your, you know, PhD in 2 or 3 years and then go to your beloved California afterwards, which is exactly what happened. And the cool part about it was that AFM was so new. I was the first one to build one of these things in Europe, actually, second one in the world. So, you know, from an academic perspective, this was great because you could essentially publish whatever, everything was new. So that was kind of really kind of a great coincidence and great opportunity. So then and I kind of did a technique of AFM to kind of image magnetic domains, magnetic structures, which is important in the magnetic recording industry. So magnetic recording industry, hard disks, tapes is what makes, you know, that's where all these YouTube videos and podcasts essentially get stored, some big tape drive somewhere in the US or somewhere around the world. And so IBM Almaden, which is in the southern end of Silicon Valley, was the mecca at that time, still is to some extent. And I somehow got this was a time before internet, et cetera. Okay, we're talking late 1980s. I got this preprint. So at that time, people sent around photocopied versions of their papers when they submitted them. That was what the original preprint was these days. It's like an electronic thing in the preprint server. With a little pasty note, one of these little yellow thingies stating like, if I would be interested in having a postdoctoral or visiting research scientist position at one of the labs there at IBM Almaden. And in my field at that time, scanning probe atomic force microscopy, IBM Almaden was the mecca. I mean, I guess probably all of you possibly have seen this, you know, the Quan Corral, where a bunch of 48 iron atoms are manipulated into a circle and atomic manipulation. So this was really the place in the world to be. And so I went off to California, to IBM, worked there for 2 years. Went back to Switzerland for 2 years to work with IBM research. And then I guess my wife and I decided we want to go to North America to start a family because there are certain things which we did not like about Switzerland. For example, the role of women at that time, things like that. And kind of like the freedom in North America. And so there were 6 places in the world where we decided I do like academia, kind of interacting with students and constantly being, you know, not taken for granted, which is slightly, there's pros and cons working in industry and in academia. And so I wanted to try academia. And so I applied to a bunch of places in 6 different cities in North America. And for whatever reason, McGill made the first offer, made the first move. And here, you know, kind of here we are. And the reason why I stayed to some extent at McGill is I think has fantastic students that have initiative and ideas and kind of do cool things, and so I learn from them constantly. Has a lot of really good stimulating colleagues in the department, faculty, university, and I don't have to kind of convince you of that. I think it's a great livable city, a great place to raise kids. And so my kids are out of the house now, but I've had offers to go back for them to Switzerland, but I think Montreal, one of these things why we moved to North America is because particularly Montreal is really a multicultural place where, it's not perfect, let's face it, but it's way more perfect than any other place that I know in that sense, too, in terms of, how things work together. And so it's work-life balance, and that's why,
Yeah, I definitely agree. So for those of us who aren't physicists, just want to get into what is so exciting and different about studying the nanoscale properties of matter.
Right. So as the introduction, this AFM thing is a tool. It's a microscope that allows you to measure properties. So image things. It's a little bit like it's a mechanical tool that measures surfaces by essentially like Brayer, like measuring the force, like the really touching the surface on atomic scale. And so I would argue these scanning probes are the ultimate nanoscale nanotechnology tool because they allow you to kind of image, so measure the structure, characterize its properties, electronic properties, like how stiff things are, mechanical properties, things like that. And you can manipulate things. So you can kind of move atoms, you can play Lego or Tinker Toys with that. So that's why I'm still excited about, and building hardware is kind of fun. So why is nano kind of, a hot or what, or kind of why are people talking about nanoscience and nanotechnology? To some extent, if you think about the macroscopic world, the size doesn't matter. So, if I take a wire, it's hard to kind of poke a hole in it. And if I make the wire half the size, it's still hard to poke a hole in it. So its mechanical properties are not really determined by its size. Most of its mechanical properties. Or you think of optical properties, like a red piece of glass is going to be red irrespective of the size of the glass. And so this is the cool part about the nanoscale is size matters. So if I now make, so that has to do with certain sense with quantum mechanics or the wave function of electrons. So if I make things small, and exactly how small is depends on the props you're looking at. But if I make things small, the props are determined by the size of the thing and the shape of the thing, and not necessarily the chemistry. So to some extent, I can make something be red or green or blue, but just changing its size. So, the optics one is kind of, I think, is a good example. If I take a piece of cadmium selenide and make it, let's say 5 nanometers in size, it's going to be red. I make it 4 nanometers in size, it's going to be orange, and then make it 2 nanometers in size, it's going to be blue. So same material, same chemistry, but just changing the size of it completely changes optical properties. Which, by the way, people knew in the past. Kind of, if you look at stained glass windows in medieval churches or kind of whatever glass cups from the Roman times or so, the artisans at that time they kind of engineered. Without understanding why, but that's a difference these days. They change the size of the gold or the silver particles that they put into the glass, and that's what makes the glass windows have a different color. It's a plasma resonance of these nanoparticles in there. So if I take a step back, the reason why I kind of like this new age of being able to engineer properties by changing the size of things, it's new in the sense of if you think like whatever historically, we had the Stone Age where tools were made out of stone, Bronze Age, Iron Age, the Industrial Revolution is based on our capabilities of actually manipulating iron. Maybe these days it's Silicon Age, that's why we have computers and podcasts and things like that. And so the idea to some extent is that the coming, the next generation or the next age is going to be materials that where it's not necessarily the chemistry that determines their properties, but it's actually chemistry, but they're essentially their size. And so that is appealing to me in that sense, just from a big picture point of view. Another reason why I think nanoscience is kind of exciting, at least to me and I think a bunch of people, is that traditional boundaries between disciplines kind of disappear. So, if you look at large things, it's kind of clear this is a, what if this is an elephant, so I'm a biologist, or this is a cell, so I'm a cell biologist, or this is a what a piece of silicon, so I might be an electric engineer, or I want to understand how defects in or dopants in silicon affect its properties, or maybe I might be a physicist. At the nanometer length scale, these traditional boundaries between different fields completely disappear. So one of my favorite examples is for example, research by Hanadi Sleeman here at the chemistry department, McGill. And she uses DNA as a construction material. So you can program DNA, or you can program the sequence of DNA to make stuff, kind of little bottles, little capsules that contain drugs or that have sensors, et cetera. So we all know from, at least I know from high school biology, that DNA is this thing that encodes for proteins in the cell. But this is not the interest. The interest here is not about the protein part. The interest is about using the whole technology that was developed for DNA sequencing, DNA synthesis, to use it for something completely different, and maybe for optical electronic properties. And so these traditional boundaries that we have, in undergrad fields, like this chemistry departments, physics departments, engineering, this is biology, they kind of completely disappear at the nanometer length scale. Nanometer length, so that's why I can kind of plug into the expertise of different fields and kind of play around with it, or kind of creatively mix and match. But I can also kind of make an impact in these different fields because I can come, out from left field in that sense. And so, in generally, I think the reason why people are fascinated by it is because essentially, it's fundamental science, understanding how stuff works, how the properties of materials are determined by their atoms, by the size of the thing. So it's essentially curiosity about how stuff works. And then and that's why governments invest a lot of money, or that's why students are interested in start taking this up, is it does have a lot of different applications, range, so that's a technology part, like ranging from the future of semiconductors, possibly IT fields, like silicon is becoming smaller and smaller, and so ultimately one will hit the, or one has hit the nanometer scale. So nanoscience will allow us to continue, improving the energy efficiency, the computation power of stuff, of materials, silicon, whatever, energy generation. So if you look at a lot of these United Nations sustainability goals, a lot of it is a materials engineer, materials science problem. And so from a fundamental kind of coming up with new solutions that that don't exist yet, nanotechnology could play a large role in energy generation, life sciences, medicine, a whole bunch of fields where there are a lot of, interesting cross-fertilizations of the tools once developed and the concepts in nanoscience.
That's an amazing answer. So you mentioned that you have your colleague that's working on DNA, and so as we know, DNA is one example of like a biological structure that has a lot of relationships between the structure and its function. How does the structure function relationship work at the nano scale, and how does this question of the relationship between structure and function change?
Right. Okay. So easier to understand one is maybe the function, the property of color. Okay. So when something absorbs light, electrons in this material excited from the ground state to an excited state. And the energy difference between the ground state and the excited state essentially determines the color of the thing. Okay. So in normal macroscopic materials, that energy difference between the ground state and excited state is determined by essentially the chemistry, like how close are the atoms together, how are they bonded, etc. But it's fundamentally by the chemistry. That's why, metal might look, that's why aluminum has a different color than gold. Okay. Because the energy difference between the lowest, between the ground state and the excited state is different to some extent. Actually, for metals, it's a bad idea. That's actually not quite true. For semiconductors. No, your LED, your red and your blue and your green LED, they have different band gaps, different energy levels, separations between the bronze and excited state. And that just has to do with the chemistry of the thing. Now, it turns out that if I'm, quantum mechanics tell, we most of the time when we kind of naively draw a picture of atom, we have this nucleus, and then we have these little black dots around it, which are the electrons that look like planets, this that are kind of swirling around the nucleus. So that's one kind of picture of how atoms look. It might not be quite correct, but that's my favorite kind of a statement. I know PowerPoint engineering or cartoon physics doesn't always reflect reality in that sense. So quantum mechanics tells you, and we have 100 years of quantum mechanics this year actually, tells you that, particles can be described by waves. The electrons can be described by a quantum mechanical wave. And so now if you think of a wave, let's say on a violin string or on a piano string, you kind of get these fundamental resonances, this like a standing wave on a string. And if you make the string shorter, you all know that from, probably everybody has plucked the guitar at some point in time or not. If you make it shorter, the tone goes up because the wavelength becomes shorter. So there's this relation between the length of the string or the chord and its frequency. And it turns out that frequency is directly related to energy. So it's proportional to energy. The proportionality constant is called Planck's constant. So a higher frequency has a higher energy. A higher frequency has a shorter wavelength. So these two things are inversely related. That's why when you kind of have your guitar string and you kind of make it shorter, the frequency goes up and the wavelength goes up. Okay. So if I now have to put my electron described as a wave into a box, it's like a standing wave in the box. So if I make my box large, my electron has a large wavelength. And if I make it shorter, like I make a shorter string on my guitar, then the wavelength of the electron is going to be shorter. The wavelength of the electron is related to its energy. So a smaller box, the electron has a higher energy. And so now you can imagine what kind of stand and the boundary condition is that the wall, it's a node of this oscillation. So if I now want to look at the first excited node in this box, the energy spacing is going to be between the first oscillation and the higher harmonics. That energy spacing or the frequency difference is going to be inversely proportional to the size of the box. So it's going to be larger if my box is smaller. And so what that means is if I make my box smaller, the light is going to go higher energy, which is bluer in the spectrum. If I make my box larger, it's going to go lower in energy, which means it's going to be redder, because I have a longer wavelength that fits into the box. And so all of a sudden, I don't really care exactly where this electron comes from, if it comes from a piece of silicon or a piece of carbon or a piece of selenium. All I care about is the size of this piece of material, which will determine what the wavelength of my electron is in it. And I can tune its spacing between these energies by changing the size of the box. And so, chemists, for example, colloidal chemists have figured out how to synthesize or control the size of the particles that you make. And so I can kind of make really small particles, which will have very high frequency short wavelengths, high frequency, high energies in them. So it'll be blue. And I'll make the box or my colloidal particle a little larger. The wavelength is going to be a little larger, a little redder. And so I can, by changing the size of the particle, all of a sudden I can change its color. So this is true for any property. There's like a critical size at which the scaling of it will not, the scaling of the properties will not change. So what is meant by scaling is that, if I think electrical resistance, no. If you take a wire, and you might have learned somewhere in high school or in 101 physics, the resistance of a wire. If you make the wire kind of, smaller cross-sectional area, the resistance is going to go up. It's essentially like, taking off a hose and kind of, make the diameter half as big, then kind of, not as much water comes out in that sense, no, because you, okay, so, and so that you can, the resistance is 1 over the square, 1 over the area of the cross-sectional area of the wire. So if you think, okay, so what happens if I make this wire smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller? And will the scaling law that the resistance goes as one over the cross-sectional area, is that still true? And at some point in time, this wire will be five atoms across or four atoms across. So it becomes discrete. Atoms are discrete. So it's not continuous anymore. I can't, And so all of a sudden I'll have jump in my resistance, and because of the electron being described as wave, there's going to be interesting interference. So all of a sudden the conductivity or the resistance of my wire will be completely different because I'm changing one atom on this thing. And so not because I'm going from, copper, which is a really good conductor, to, let's say, iron, which is kind of pretty crappy conductor, but because I've changed the size of this thing. So I can control electronic properties again by changing size. So that's the second example. And it's done, this one happens at, at the nanometer length scale. Because that's where the size of atoms starts mattering. So those are what two major drivers, I think, in nanotechnology, the fact that optical and electronic properties at the nanometer length scale are determined by primarily by size and less so by the chemistry. And then a whole bunch of other things, chemical reactivities change. That's why, from a biological or a medical point of view, those things might be interesting in that sense.
You emphasized size as a parameter that changes the properties of the material, but how might the actual material composition affect those, like optical or electrical properties? Like, if I use gold versus silver, how would that change things?
To some extent, it's a secondary effect. And to some extent, the size at which something happens might be different. So, if I make the two different materials of different composition the same size, they will not have exactly the same color, for example. It might matter a little bit, but I can kind of make material A have the same color as material B if I change its, if I if I change the size, if I change the size to that. So it's not that it doesn't play a role at all anymore. It's just it's not the dominant role anymore. And the statement is generically not true. It depends really on which properties you're looking at. In general, what you really want to just look at, and that's maybe that's also like, when is it nano and when is it just like small? So you want to see which property, the scaling law of which property, the scaling means how does it change as a function of size? Which scaling law breaks down at what length scale, possibly what temperature? So if there's a change in, if I take my piece of silicon and have a large piece, it's going to be whatever this golden color that silicon has. I'm going to make it smaller and smaller and smaller, still golden, 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 golden. So it's scaling is doesn't depend on size, and all of a sudden it depends. And that where this all of a sudden happens at what size, that's when the scaling law for silicon breaks down. Now, if you take a piece of gold, that the size, where does it turn red or so, might be a slightly different size than for silver, etc. So that's why it's not a, so that's why one can't say, oh, anything below 30 nanometers is nanoscience or nanotechnology, everything above is not. It really depends on what property you're looking at, which sometimes makes it, particularly the beginning of this, kind of made it hard because 999 nanometer size doesn't really mean it's nanoscience in that sense, but in some situations it could, and in some cases 10 nanometers is still classical and is not nanotechnology and nanoscience yet. So it's really this breakdown of the scaling law that, in my view, matters. So that's where you get new properties, because otherwise it's no, most materials have really cool and interesting properties, so I don't need nano for that. But it's the opportunities that are offered by all of a sudden having new stuff, new properties appear because of the size of the thing. And are these properties useful or not? That's a different question.
That's really interesting and a little bit weird also. Quite a break from I feel like the intuition we have just from living in the world. It's I feel like the intuition doesn't really apply anymore at this scale.
Correct.
So that's really interesting. I'd like to hop a little bit back. You spoke a bit about AFM. So I'd like to ask you a few more questions about how exactly you study these structures and these properties. So you've already explained a little bit about how the AFMs work, but could you elaborate a bit more about what makes it special compared to maybe other techniques, or what other techniques also exist to study properties at this nanoscale, maybe electron microscopy or something else?
Right. So I'll answer your second question first and then explain how the AFM works. So there are a lot of techniques out there, as you mentioned, that allow you to see things that or kind of characterize things at the nanometer length scale, mostly structural. So electron microscopy allows you to do structural and chemical. So where are the atoms or what is the size of the thing and where, you know, what kind of atoms are you looking at? So what is it a carbon atom or a gold atom, et cetera. So electron microscopy is, you know, you can achieve atomic resolution, so you can see where individual atoms are in the material. But it kind of doesn't really work in many environments in that sense. And sample prep often is an issue, so which is true for all these microscopies. So what that means is I have a hard time looking at a living cell in an electron microscope just because the electron microscopes are in a vacuum, so I have to freeze it, and then I can do real amazing things in terms of, you know, cryo TM, et cetera. I can transmission electron microscopy. I can look at where all the proteins are, where all the atoms and proteins are, et cetera. So it's really powerful in that respect. But it's not a living organism, and I can't get any dynamics out of it. So in a certain sense, it's, you know, that all these different techniques are complementary to each other. And so depending on what question you're asking the sample, you might have to use more than one in that sense. The predecessor and still very active field, amazing technique is to the AFM is a tool called the scanning tunneling microscope. Has a lot of similarities in terms of technical implementations. The major difference is that what scanning tunneling microscopy uses is tunneling, the quantum mechanical tunneling of electrons between a metallic tip and a conductive sample. And it turns out that this tunneling current, because of the wave function of electrons that we talked about before, is exponentially dependent on the separation between tip and sample. And it changes the tunneling current by an order of magnitude if you change the tip sample separation by 0.1 nanometers, by one angstrom. And so one atom is about one angstrom in size. So if you're above an atom or between atoms, you see an order of magnitude difference in signal. And so that's how you actually trace out atoms on the surface. The challenge is it really has to be a conductive tip and sample. And if you look around, most materials aren't conductive. So it kind of doesn't work for that. It's a really cool tool and it's inspirational. And the quantum corral, the thing that I mentioned before, was done by manipulating atoms and kind of imaging where the electrons are, et cetera, where electron waves are, et cetera. And a lot of the technology was developed for STM. But one fairly quickly realized 5 years after. 5 years or so after the invention or discovery of this scanning tunneling microscope, that it would be really cool if one could actually apply a similar principle without having to measure a current. And so that's where the atomic force microscope came in. So essentially, and that's why I kind of like it because it's kind of a conceptually fairly simple, and in the details implementation, as it's poses interesting challenges. Let's put it this way. So measuring forces. No, the reason why you and I are not falling through our chairs right now is because there's a repulsive force between our backside and the chair. This is due to the repulsion of the Pauli repulsion, essentially. Repulsive force. No, similar like if I were visually impaired, I would read with Braille. I would run my finger, and I would feel roughness on the surface. Okay, so now if you kind of think about if I can make my finger be atomically sharp. And that can be done. I can trace out where the atoms are and where I'm between the atoms by just kind of scanning this finger across the surface. And that's literally what an AFM does. It takes a really sharp tip. And one routine way how people generate, or how many people generate really sharp tips, is attaching a CO molecule to it, to the tip. And so you have the oxygen orbital that is actually your sharp finger. And most of the tips that you use these days are just standard microfabrication. So standard, that's the progress that we had in microelectronics that allows to etch things down to nanometer length scale. So these are sharp, really sharp tips. And so now, so that way I can localize the repulse, or I can localize the forces. I can measure all kinds of forces, repulsive forces, van der Waals forces, attractive forces, electrostatic, magnetic forces, et cetera. So now you have to ask yourself, how do you measure force? Okay, so fundamentally, one straightforward way of how to measure force is by measuring the expansion of a spring. So again, if you've ever done a first-year physics lab experiment, you probably did Hooke's law. We have this little spring thing, and you add a mass to it, a force to it, and you kind of plot how does extension of the spring change as a function of the mass you attached, and you get a straight line, and that straight line is the spring constant. And so any structure that you can form into spring, if I can measure the deflection of that spring or the how much it moves, I can actually measure the force acting on this spring. So if I attach my sharp tip to a spring, and the spring, for example, the springs we use are not like little coily things or diving board structures. So, you've all probably seen or stood on a diving board, and if you kind of, put more force on it, it bends more. And so, that's exactly what we measure. And one way of measuring that deflection is by sensitive optics, lots of different ways of doing that. So I can measure the change in my diving board, the deflection in my diving board, by seeing the change in the optical signal reflected off this diving board. If I know the spring constant, Hooke's law, spring constant of this diving board, I know the force acting on my tip. So I can kind of trace out lines of constant force across the surface by using some suitable feedback circuit. And if I want to do this even more sophisticated, then, for those of, I'm sure you've heard, but for those of you that have heard of the harmonic oscillator, if you look at, if you take your springboard or kind of a ruler and you clamp it on one side and you go poing, that frequency is, also that resonance frequency is the square root of the spring constant divided by the mass of the spring. So I can measure resonance frequencies much more sensitively than I can measure static deflections, and resonance frequencies are affected by forces between the tip, force grains between the tip and the sample. So I can measure exceedingly small forces. I can measure, thousandth. I can measure like let the force that are much smaller than force to form a chemical bond in that sense. And so, because also partially because we figured out, or we in the community has figured out how to measure really, really small deflections of this chemical. So in our lab, we can measure the change in mechanical status of the deflection of this cantilever of about 10 to minus 15 meters per 1 second averaging time in that sense. So 10 to minus 15 meters is a diameter of your nucleus. So it's very sensitive measurements. And that's just because people have been fiddling around with this for 39 years now. That's 4 years. Just I just want to kind of just re remember, like I've been, we've been talking about nanometers, and that might not be that obvious to everyone how small a nanometer is actually. So I mean, your diameter of your hair is about 100 micrometers, so that's 100,000 nanometers, okay? And if I had, and then as I said, like an atom is about a tenth of a nanometer in size. Maybe 2/10, but okay, let's say 1/10. So if I magnify that atom to, well, like the size of an apple, at that size, at that magnification, the Earth would be, so the real apple would be about the size of Earth in that sense. No? So nanometers are really, really small. And still, like, we can routinely on a daily basis image this stuff and kind of, you get somewhat blasé about, because I think it's interesting. That's why I triggered, you mentioned before, like some of these things are non-intuitive. Like, look, my length scale intuition goes, I don't know, maybe slightly less than a millimeter, because that's what I can see, to something about, a few kilometers, because that's how far I can kind of walk before I get tired, kind of thing, or run. But anything larger, it's kind of, we don't, our scale is 1 meter. That's, so we're roughly of the order of a meter in size. No. And so 1,000 times smaller, micrometer. Or millimeter, let's say 10,000 times smaller, 10,000 times larger, which is 10 kilometers. We roughly have a feeling for anything else. I don't know. And so that's why it's kind of, it is counterintuitive. On the other hand, what is really cool about it is, I think, and that's why I kind of like it a lot, is mechanics, doesn't really break down at very, at these length scales in that sense. So I can use my classical macroscopic Hooke's law, big spring kind of thing. To give you an idea, the other part that it's important to understand why the AFM works is what are typical interatomic forces. So, they're about a nanonewton, which is fairly easy to so the length of a newton. And so, if I have a spring constant of 1 newton per meter, and I apply 1 nanonewton, like the interatomic force between two atoms, that'll deflect this thing by 1 nanometer. And as I just told you, we can easily measure a lot of a much smaller deflection. So, from that perspective, and then 1 newton per meter is not a very, hard spring to get. Like when I was a grad student, the way we made these cantilever springs was take a little piece of aluminum foil, cut it into 10 millimeters and 1 millimeter wide thing with an X-Acto knife. That thing has a newton per meter spring constant. That works as an AFM force sensor empirically, my thesis on that. And, you've probably, when you were kids, at some point in time, played with a slinky toy, like this little, call it springy thing that kind of jumps all over the place. That thing has a 1 newton per meter spring constant. So with that, if you could measure the change in length of that thing to nanonewton, which is really straightforward to do these days, it could do it for less than $10 in that sense. You could measure interatomic forces with it, which is really kind of, so this concept of a chemical bond, how strong it is, etc. In biology, mechanical forces are really important to determine if things become a neuron or a bone cell is determined by the mechanics of its environment. That can be probed in that sense. So the big advantage of AFM, I think, just to come back again to the second part of the question that I kind of asked first, is that this force measurement works in any environment on any material. So it's ideal for technology, material science, physics, chemistry, bio, or medicine. So, I can measure magnetic signals. That's my original introduction question. That's the reason why I went to IBM, because this was an exploratory storage studies group. So we were developing new hard. One of the goals was to develop new hard drives. In material science, you can kind of figure out things like the conductivity of lithium in a battery material, like how fast, what are the ultimate limits of how fast you can charge a battery, which is important to know from a technology development point of view and social acceptance of batteries as a replacement of other things. And in physics, that's mainly my current research, or my group's current research, is we'd like to understand the properties of defects in of the electronic electrostatic properties in def of defects for quantum information, for quantum computing. In chemistry, it's probably the best way of determining the structure of small molecules, because you can see every single bond. I can tell you if it's a double bond or a single bond just by measuring the force across it. In biology, you can kind of measure the forces and the torque of a molecular motor, like these myosin things that transport stuff in a cell. From a mechanical engineering point of view, like what is the stalling torque of this thing? What is the energy efficiency of it? What happens if you have some sort of, that can actually be quantitatively measured and figured out if we know the structure of these things from cryo-TEM. Do we actually understand why it's so strong or so powerful? And of course, to some extent, this is the idea of if you really understand biology, you can reverse engineer some of these concepts in biology because they're a proof of concept that they're possible, but they're not necessarily proof that evolution chose the best material because it kind of got stuck in quantum chemistry kind of gazillions of years ago. So understanding the principles might actually allow you to then engineer things which are even more efficient based on these biological principles. So reverse engineering biology or biomedics, I guess, is a really hot field there. You can kind of do in medicine, for example, one of the things you can do is cancer cells have slightly different mechanical properties. So I can kind of poke them and they're more viscoelastic because they can kind of creep into different things than healthy cells. So if I have a biopsis, I can kind of figure out, if I were a surgeon, that cut out enough, and usually one cuts out plenty enough to make sure that there's no cancer cells left. But if I could measure the mechanical properties of each cell as I do, I could be minimally invasive in that sense. So that's a fascinating part because I've stuck my nose into many of these things in that sense because, as I said, at nanometer length scale, the traditional boundaries are not there, so you can kind of, you can kind of get engaged in whatever you kind of think is interesting or I think is interesting for the moment, then move on to the next. Just kind of, that's why I like this field. And AFM, because it allows you to, all these other techniques, you're kind of limited. You can't do it in electrochemistry, or you can't do it on a living neuron kind of thing, because these things do not like being put into vacuum or wrong current for them.
Wow, yeah, that's really cool. We'll ask you about some of those applications in a little bit. But yeah, it's so cool that we've reached a point where we have the technology that's so diverse yet so sensitive also. It's quite amazing. So you mentioned a couple of the predecessors there of current AFM, STM, you mentioned. We'd like to ask you a little bit about what you're working more at the cutting edge. We've seen that your group excels really at pioneering new techniques that use the AFM to enable activities like precise measurement of ultra-fast femtosecond processes. Could you please share some of the standout techniques you've developed with the AFM in the past and what upgrades you're currently working on for the future?
Okay, so my research can be kind of split, or my things that my students do, or my research program in that sense can be split into two parts. One of them is methods or tool development, because that then allows you to do new things which kind of open new frontiers, or kind of that other people, that other groups can't do. So it's a competitive advantage. It's also great training for students, because that's what gets them jobs in the end, that they can actually build stuff. And then use those for interesting science or science question. So, from a big picture point of view, you could kind of argue that I'd like to know the ultimate limits, both in terms of tools, or AFMs in this case, and the samples we're looking at. So ultimate limits, for example, how fast can you measure something? So we developed, we demonstrated that you can actually measure signals which are 100 femtosecond fast with a mechanical oscillator, AFM, kind of a cantilever that is much, much slower. So essentially same, so this essentially took concepts from optics, ultra-fast optics, and transferred them to mechanics in that sense. And so with that thing, we're trying to understand things like when you shine light on matter, or certain matter, it generates electron holes, which are called excitons. And these things, that's what happens in your photovoltaic cell. They get separated and you get a current flowing, in that sense, electrons flow through a circuit. But these electron holes, they kind of wander around your material. There might be defects where they get recombined. And so we want to kind of see how fast they move as a function of the structure of the molecular atomic scale structure of some organic systems in that sense. So you really understand what determines charge separation and what determines mobility of charges in organic systems, because there's a lot of really interesting things one can engineer or synthesize into organic systems, in contrast to things like silicon. But one doesn't really understand the defects that well, because it hasn't been investigated that well. And so that's why we need to develop ultra-fast parts. So understand the ultimate limits of the instrumentation, and then the ultimate limits of charge separation on the molecular scale.
So earlier we spoke a bit about those particles whose size determines the light that they emit. And so, as you know, we were talking a bit about quantum dots, which were the subject that earned the Nobel Prize of Chemistry in 2023. So could you elaborate a bit more about what exactly quantum dots are and why they are so important?
So essentially, the fact that they, okay, so how do you actually, so in biology in particular, you label a lot of things with kind of fluorescence groups. So often this is done with GFP. So this is this protein that is derivative from some jellyfish. And that way you can kind of track what is happening in the cell as it's doing whatever cells do as it grows or multiplies, et cetera. So you can label this protein, that protein. If you want to figure out how a neuron forms a synapse, you label all the different proteins that are in the, that you know that are in the synapse, and you want to figure out where does this guy go? At what time does it get transported there? What is the stimulus that leads to the synapse formation? And so now the traditional, or most of these labeling colors in that sense, or the entities that from a photophysics, from a photostability point of view, have limitations. So if you shine too much light at them, they somehow change structure a little bit, they oxidize and they bleach. And so then your light beacon goes out and I don't know where my protein is anymore. And so I have a hard time tracking things over extended periods, or I need such a lot of light power that my biology gets affected by it. And so quantum dots, these, where you can, where I can engineer the color of the light by just changing the size and by developing suitable synthesis techniques, they are much more photostable. So what that means is they don't bleach as fast and they shine, they give out more light per stimulation in that sense. So they're kind of like really very bright flat beacons, and I can engineer many different colors because it can make their emission wavelength very, very narrow. So I can have 10 different colors. So I can track 10 different things instead of maybe three different things, because getting green jelly or genetically manipulating green jellyfish protein so that it's green, red, and yellow is already tough. Never mind red and things like that. And so I might have three or four colors max, and it's bleaching to some extent. Whereas I can really barcode stuff by having dozens of colors in the same cell. And I just then use a spectral filter to kind of track, oh, this is whatever, this protein, that's that protein, and I can see where it's going in that sense. So in the biology, that's why I think it's one of the useful, very useful things. Same thing with photovoltaics. I can, the band gap, the thing that we talked about before, the space in between, the particle box, between the lowest energy level and the high next energy level. So the thing that absorbs light, that band gap for macroscopic things, semiconductor, silicon, solar cell, is given by the chemistry of the material. If you look at the solar spectrum, it's broadband. It's much broader than the narrow part that I can kind of extract with my solar cell, my silicon solar cell, which is the technology, the material that is used these days. So there are ideas around that one might be able to extract more of the solar spectrum by essentially having absorbers or kind of convert sunlight into electricity that are tuned to different wavelengths of the sunlight. So essentially generating even more power out of a solar cell than you can currently do. Now, there's challenges in terms of how much will that cost, environmental challenges, etc. But fundamentally, that's the idea. So the fact that I can actually tune my absorption wavelength from a photovoltaics point of view is really attractive. And one of the major applications where it's already being used is, I can also emit light that has very tunable color, and it's very bright light. So you can buy TVs, I think from Samsung, that actually use these quantum dots as light sources. So they're very bright, large TVs that you can see the picture in daylight or whatever, that have very brilliant colors because there's more photons per pixel coming out. The pixel are small, so you can kind of put more of them in it. So it's both from a light source point of view, as well as turning light into electricity, as well as in biology. I think that these quantum dots will are starting to play a large role, or transiting from fundamental science to technology in that sense.
Yeah, that's awesome to hear. So there are still a lot of unanswered questions about how quantum dots work. So I wanted to ask, how might atomic force microscopy help answer some of these unknowns about quantum dots?
That's actually a hard one because I'm not that much of an expert in the optical properties of quantum dots. So one of the things that quantum dots do is they blink. So what that means is they might be emitting light nicely, and all of a sudden they turn off, and after a while they come back up again. What exactly is happening there is non-trivial. A lot of optical spectroscopy techniques can help answer that. I think one of the things that AFM can help is, you can measure the charge state of a quantum dot, like is it charged or not, by just looking at this electrostatic force. And if you can correlate that with the blinking part and at what energy this happens, etc., that might give you some insights into what is, why is this thing blinking, and how to either use the blinking as a resource. The blinking probability, for example, could depend on pH, so the number of hydrogen ions or hydrogen available in the solution. So you might be able to use the blinking statistics as a local reporter of pH in a cell. Some cells have a higher pH than others, depending on their status. Cancer cells are supposedly have a slightly higher pH. And so that and then just fundamentally understanding, can you actually engineer so that they don't blink, or that they blink more, or kind of no. Do you understand the blinking part? And so I'm not really sure that I if I wanted to answer the this question, if AFM were the idea, it might be a part of the answer to the problem, but I definitely think it's not the only. I think different optical spectroscopy technique, time-resolved optical spectroscopy techniques are very powerful. They might have a problem of looking at one individual one, but that might actually not be necessary to understand the problem in the process in that sense. So you really have to kind of make sure that you really need to know it from one particle and not from an ensemble of particles. And maybe you can develop a hypothesis or the hypothesis that you've developed, and now you can test it out if on an individual particle this is actually true or not in that sense, or if there's something else on it.
So we've mentioned biology a couple of times now, which is really cool because that's one of the things that originally brought our attention to your work was the fact that you have applied, or your group has applied AFM to biology in the past. So we're hoping you give us a quick overview of some of the amazing ways AFM has been applied to the life sciences. You mentioned cancer cells. I don't know if you have any other cool examples where AFM has been used to tackle problems in the life sciences.
Well, so my favorite example is, so I often get approached by colleagues here in biology that, or physiology, life sciences, that want to have image of this or that. And we often do that just because I think it's good training for the students to be exposed to something else. And if we can kind of, in a fairly reasonable amount of time, solve the problem, then it's kind of interesting in that sense. So I've had a project for several years, which was finished a few years ago, with researchers at the Montreal Neurological Institute, on neuroscience, on synapse formation. And I still kind of like that project, and I think it's a cool project. So the way this started was that David Coleman, who was the director of the MNI at that time, and I somehow got together, and they were trying to understand which protein, they were trying to understand synapse formation and which proteins got into the synapse junction at what time. And what they were doing was they were sprinkling beads at the surface, and then some of them got stuck, and then some. Anyway, so long story short, we used the AFM as a glorified manipulator to kind of take a bead with the chemist, with the, whatever the hypothesis was, the chemistry attached to this bead, and kind of touched a synapse with a certain amount of force, and then watched with fluorescence microscopy as these fluorescently labeled proteins were transported in. So we could kind of generate like a map, a time map of what came in at what time. Could also show that you can form a synapse anywhere on the neuron, that there are not predetermined sites. And we could also, we did the, then kind of naturally, it's kind of that the physicist like, well, let me see what happens if I squeeze this thing, so trauma, we could figure out different types of neurons, what their maximum pressure was at which they kind of died in that sense. We could figure out the pathway by which they died, which is, that's essentially when you get a head trauma, a certain acceleration gets exceeded, and then neurons kind of get squished. So that was kind of interesting. So this was the major reason why we did this project, and that kind of, and then at some point in time, when this, so when we did this touching of the synapse of the neuron to form a synapse, then you have a time lapse. You have video that goes for an hour until you see all the proteins, whatever synaptifies and whatever, being transported into the gap, making this synapse form. And then at some point in time, one of the students, Fernando Suarez, he kind of didn't cut the video off before he finished the experiment, because he always showed me the videos slightly edited, which I did not realize. And in this video, it was until the end, and you could see him pull away the bead, and you could see this little kind of thing that got pulled out of the neuron. This was a fluorescently labeled neuron. And somehow, I kind of, wow! And he was somewhat disappointed because it was a really successful experiment. He was somewhat disappointed that I wasn't more interested in the first 59 minutes, that I was more fascinated and kind of excited and jumping up and down about this little thing that he was pulling out. Because for me, this showed, hey, we can pull out a neuron. We can pull out a neuron. Can we manipulate neurons? And so this was then part two of his thesis, and we also had a really smart research associate, Margaret McDesian. And then, making a long story short, we figured out how we can manipulate neurons and how we can actually connect neurons together by using force manipulation on these things. So instead of kind of, and to do that, we also had to develop a whole bunch of technology, a whole bunch of microfluidics devices to grow a whole bunch of axons in parallel so we could do reproducible experiments. This was really kind of, I thought this was really cool because in the end, what we wanted to build was a neural network that could actually measure or see stuff. So I wanted to kind of build a perceptron that would allow it to recognize the numbers 1 to 9, the 0, 1, 2, 3, 4. So essentially, instead of building a neural computer with silicon, I wanted to build a neural computer with wetware, like with neurons. We kind of had the proof of principle we could do it, and we could show that we could actually transmit signals and everything. So these things were not distinguishable from the naturally grown ones. The challenge was to kind of convince the granting agency that some physicist thinks he knows how to build a neural network, get the neuroscientists interested, because this was kind of far out from their comfort zone. And machine learning guys weren't interested in 10 neurons or something like that. They wanted to build something that can, distinguish dogs and cats in that sense. And so it never got funded. And so then the pandemic came and the students graduated. And so this program, for this project, kind of got terminated in that sense, which, to some extent, I'm still sad because I still think it'd be kind of cool if one could manipulate neurons and build some. But no, so in a certain sense, I think we learned a lot about how neurons form synapses, but what kind of leads, what the mechanisms are when you have when things go bad in neurons, like trauma. And we learned how to build microfluidics platforms where you can have a lot of neurons or a lot of axons in parallel, so you can expose them to as a drug testing device or whatever. And so this is actually not, this was spun out by Margaret McDesian. So I'm not involved in it, but she started a company called Ananda Devices about 10 years ago or so, which is very successful, has about 20 PhD students or PhDs apply, and they do tissue neuron-infused tissue testing for a whole bunch of things. For example, many places in the world, particularly Europe, allow to do cosmetics or testing or down the road drug testing on living organisms. So you have to have some sort of realistic skin system or realistic system, including neurons, to kind of test new things. And that's and so this so 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 this this really goes from like fundamental question, like what forms a synapse, what is needed, and it turns out it's just a positive charge. Any positively charged molecule will lead to synapse formation, which is kind of surprisingly simple. Why that is a different question. To kind of know, hey, we can kind of do surgery on neurons. We can fit them together and make them functional, and they're not distinguishable by any biochemical means, by any transport measurements, so double patch clamp things, or by structural things. They look like a duck, they walk like a duck, they quack like a duck, they are a duck despite the fact that I used an AFM to pull them, kind of thing. And you could pull them way faster than naturally grow. So ultimate limits. Like, why can I? Why does what limits how fast neurons can grow together again in a real organism? Like, which is the reason why when you cut a neuron, a nerve, it doesn't grow together anymore, because essentially you get scar tissue. And if the neuron could grow faster than the scar tissue grows, it would reconnect to your finger or to your hand that you cut off, in that sense. No. And so it's not the limit on the neuron, it must be something else, because we can pull this thing 100 times faster than it naturally grows, and it's still functional.
So I think, it's about time to wrap up. So we just have one last question for you. So we talked a bit about the real life applications of nanotechnology, but transitioning research into like commercial products is extremely challenging. So what sort of barriers exist when scaling up your work with AFM and everything else? And how do researchers and other collaborators work together to overcome those barriers?
That's an interesting question. So, I mean, so we commercialize or we protect, and then we kind of transfer the tech for some of the methods we've developed, some of the AFM methods. That's pretty straightforward. You find a company that commercializes AFMs, and there's a whole bunch of them. And if it's useful, they will pay licensing fees for that. And if it's not obvious, you know, and in some cases, we do it open source because we believe it's better for the, you know, this is not something that is really that valuable. The market should not be cornered by one company. This is too valuable for the community, and so we just make it available to the community. The sample insights, you know, that part is takes more than AFM in that sense. It's so that's the interdisciplinary team that you have to kind of figure out, you know, is it novel? Is it non-obvious to the expert? And is it useful? The three questions you have to answer if you want to have a patent, or if you want to have an invention, or actually, in my view, also if you want to write a good paper, right? That's three questions I think you really need to figure out. I think in general, like, you know, say we discover some interesting properties about a new material in that sense, you know, I don't. Oh, this is how you cut this is how you have to protect the defect. These are the types of defects you need on this copper surface to have an efficient CO2 to fuel converter, electrical. That's not a business model yet. And so I think very often what we as academics don't understand that well is the business proposition. No, money makes the world go round, and the company has to make money. And so one needs to understand the business side. One needs to understand the state of the art and its challenges, and one needs to understand the competing technologies in that sense. And so again, that needs probably a bunch of people that, you know, are not just necessarily physicists that or biologists. Suddenly you might need somebody from business, somebody from finance, and you need probably to figure out what is real, what are you competing with in that sense. You know, my favorite example I respect is, like, you know, I read so many grant applications where somebody comes up with some material, some maybe some nanomaterial, and the statement states that, though, this will replace silicon because we all know Moore's Law is coming to an end. Well, silicon is a really good industry. They know how to do stuff. It's a $1 trillion industry. You come up with some invention, it takes a lot more than being better in one parameter to beat silicon, because, you know, so let's say generating one bit by moving a atom around with an AFM, which is great science and fun to do, that's not a technology. Is it scalable? How much will it cost to scale this? And if it costs 10 times more than the current technology, it's not going to have a market, because no, you know, you and I will not be willing to pay 10 times more for a gigabyte of storage just because it's moved. I don't care what is inside this thing. I care that it works and that it's inexpensive. No. And so there are technologies out there that have such a lot of experience in terms of the people making these things, and, you know, what it's useful for, et cetera, that it's that you really have to have a very deep understanding there to actually make an impact in that sense. So I know I view the role of a university mainly in kind of exploring what are the ultimate limits, and that might be very far away from actually a product in that sense. And having, you know, creative new ideas, training good people in that sense. I think that's and generally you ask about people. I think one really needs a good sense of what actually makes a company work, and what is the value proposition. Look, I mean, when the internet was invented to kind of move data around, this was nobody, none of the people that actually invented the internet thought that this is going to be a great business. No. You know, it was invented to essentially survive an atomic bomb explosion, to have secure communication between sites, and then to some extent to move large amounts of data around from CERN in that sense. But there was no business model behind it. It was just kind of technology to move large amounts of data around more or less securely. And then, you know, only when the Google guys came along and figured out, hey, I can actually commercialize this, and I can actually make it for free that you and I use Google Maps and Google and whatever, and I'm going to charge somebody else to run ads, and how will this be monetized? That is a really interesting algorithmic and conceptual and financial how do you actually, how much am I going to charge you for that? That part has nothing to do with the technology of how an internet works in that sense. But if you look at where all the money's made these days, it's, the Amazons of the world, the Googles of the world, the Facebooks of the world. They're all based on something which is not necessarily the technology. So in that analogy, it's not based on the AFM technology, it's based on some creative idea of a business opportunity in that sense. And so that can come. I mean, these days, if these examples, if you look at the high tech, most of it, they were kind of engineers, scientists in that sense. But and I think that's maybe a sign of the times in that sense. But that MBAs play less of a role in small scientists in that sense. But to scale these things, you will somehow need to understand something about business.
I think that wraps it up for us today. Thank you so much for talking with us. This is so interesting to talk more about like physics and AFM
Sure.
and a little bit of biology sprinkled in there as well.
Well, thank you for kind of a stimulating questions or so. Kind of, it's always fun to talk to you. Thanks so much, Molly and Nick.
Thank
you.
you for your time, Doctor.